Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves and it's great not to be talking about the election for once. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin McMahon. And Martin, I have to say, the sun is actually coming down behind you and your ears are lit up. So
have I an areola?
Am I saying the right word? You're like a Baroque painting.
Yeah, Listen, guys, thanks for everybody listening. We need more patrons. Please come on board. It costs us money to put these out there. We enjoy doing it. Hit up the website, tortoiseshack.ie, and just log in there and cup of coffee. Boom, done.
Much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack. He's come all the way to the Tortoise Shack. Fair play to him. Gavin Sheridan, CEO of Is Legal, co-founder of Right to Know, Mr. the man behind the story.ie with Storyful. Gavin, I'm running out of things, but there's a lot more to you than just, you make me and him look really boring.
I don't know about that. I think it makes me sound like a multitasking idiot, to be honest. Yeah. Probably doing too many things at once.
No, thanks for coming. I really appreciate it. I know you're from the other end of the country, and we won't hold that against you.
Just let the dubs know. It's a place called Cork.
Yeah. It's a fantastic place. It's a fantastic place.
As someone who's married to a Cork woman, I'm
can't say that wrong.
Although it wasn't Barry's that I got there now a minute ago.
No, the teeth. No, look, can I ask you, you're obviously, we've just touched on the fact that you're involved in a lot of stuff, right? But Right to Know itself, do you want to just explain to listeners what Right to Know is and what the idea was?
Yeah, so I guess Right to Know is a not-for-profit company that we set up a few years ago, and its origins are in the story.ie, which goes back a decade now. And it was set up by myself and Mark Coughlin, who now works in RTE as a journalist. And we kind of had this idea back in 2009. We actually met, coincidentally, at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis in 2009. That was the first Fianna Fáil Ardéis where they let bloggers in for the first time.
Right.
And Mark was studying, I think, in Ballyferm at journalism at the time. And he and me hit it off because we were doing things like live tweeting during... during the Ardéis.
I forgot, I should have said that. Your original Twitter, but go on.
but tweeting, and Susie Byrne was there from Mam and Poulet, and all the journalists were kind of looking at us skeptically. We were using this thing called Twitter, and we were live blogging.
Yeah.
And they were like, what are these people doing? And we were taking videos of politicians and stuff in real time, putting them on YouTube straight away, and then sharing them on Twitter, and people were like, this is all a bit weird. So I met Mark Coughlin at that, and we got talking over 2009. Coincidentally, also, he introduced me to Mark Little, which is another separate story to do with Storyful. But we got interested in FOI, and one of the approaches we made was, let's set up a website as an experiment to systematically file access to information requests, where the objective is not necessarily looking for a story or, you know, a 500-word piece plus a headline in a newspaper. I was working in the Irish Examiner at the time in production, but the objective was, I wonder if we can get information of a different nature, because we were at this kind of taking interest in data journalism at the time and interested in spreadsheets and databases and getting access to information. So we started the story.ie and we said, okay, we're going to publish, I think the first blog post we did was to aggregate all of the expense claims and donations. Or no, it was the donations of all the, to all politicians ever since records began in the late 90s, and we put it all into a massive spreadsheet, and we said, here's all the donations that have been given to politicians. And it got a huge reaction at the time, and you know, that in those days Twitter was much smaller, but people said, can we do anything to help? And we just put in a PayPal button, because at the time you had to pay €15 for FOI requests. And then we started then kind of systemizing our approach towards finding requests, and essentially that boiled down to looking for interesting things that people hadn't asked for before, and then looking for precedent. And second thing was filing requests like obsessively, like 3 or 4 a week for years. Because what we had an idea was, if you build up a flow of requests, you'll always have stuff coming to you, even if it's refusals.
Yes.
And you're also testing, I suppose, the system of FOIs as well.
Kicking the tires.
Yeah, and it involved at the time a lot of printing out letters, buying stamps, getting postal orders or writing checks. Because that was, you couldn't file them by email. You had to write them out and print them out and send them.
Yeah.
How did you find FOI at the time? Because I was doing some FOIs around that time as well. And I found that it was kind of automatic refusal, and you had to go to the next level pretty much automatically.
Yeah, that was kind of my experience as well. And I think one of my earliest FOIs was actually to FOI Ken Fox's FOI. So I was in the Examiner at the time as a sub-editor, and Ken was doing this amazing set of stories in the Sunday Tribune that summer over John O'Donoghue's expenses.
Yes.
And I was reading the Sunday Tribune every Sunday, and I was saying to myself, this is a great story, but it's not getting the play. At the time, the Tribune didn't have a website, and I was kind of going, this is a great story, but why is it not getting any pickup? So I FOI'd his FOI to the department. I said, I want everything that Ken got. Now, I wasn't trying to scoop him.
Yeah.
Ken has, me and Ken get on very well. But what I was trying to do was get the information.
Of this parish.
Yeah. And I wanted to get the information. And the reason I wanted to get it was because I'm a blogger. And I was like, we'll just start putting this shit online.
Mm. Yeah. And yeah, yeah.
So I remember getting the documents in the post in Cork. And it was, you know, a big, thick, brown envelope of all the documents that Ken had been sent. And I split them up into all the different trips that John O'Donoghue had been on as Minister for Tourism. And I started scanning them in my scanner. Mm. And I started putting them on the blog. And I went on politics.ie, run by David Cochrane at the time, I think it was. And I started putting them on. I started a thread. I said, by the way, see these stories Ken Fox has been doing. Here's the first batch of documents. This is his trip to India.
Mm.
Now, that whole process that summer, it was a very interesting process in how FOI can be used.
Mm.
Because once you start putting them online, everybody could see them.
Yeah.
And then everybody started interrogating them. Now, Ken is a really, really exceptional journalist, but he wouldn't necessarily see every detail because he has to get the story out. He has an editor to deal with. And people were kind of parsing the documents. And I was deliberately not putting them all out at once. I was staging the release every 3 to 4 days in order to kind of get over weekend news cycles and stuff like that. So I remember, I think it was on a Wednesday or Thursday, I put up a set of documents. I think it might have been the Indian trip. And I blogged about it and put a thread on politics.ie. And people started noticing this trip that John O'Donoghue had taken between Terminal 1 and Terminal 3 in Heathrow.
Oh, yeah.
With a limousine that had cost 492 odd euro, which was one very small detail in a whole batch of documents.
Mm.
And somebody wrote a comment going, what's the story with this? And what's the story with that? And all of a sudden, the story got legs.
Yeah.
And between, and you knew the story was a story once it started getting traction in the Daily Mail, it started getting traction in the Irish Times and the Irish Independent. But then we knew it was in a news cycle when it jumped the weekend. So it was written about on the Sundays. And then I started publishing another batch of documents on a Monday or Tuesday. And it still was going.
Mm.
And then it started being talked about on the radio. And then it got legs. And then it started to gain momentum as a result. And at the time, and this is kind of the origin story of FOI for me, is that when I was kind of looking at that, one of the things that we noticed in the documents that we got from that FOI, and I was talking to a friend of mine who was working in BBC Panorama at the time, who I'd met at the Investigative Journalism Summer School in London, Elena Gawhari, and she was doing a lot of data at the time. She looked and she was like, well, obviously this is a database. Mm. And I was like, well, yeah. Because at the bottom, in the footer of the printed out documents, was a kind of a URL, an intranet URL. And I was like, yeah, there is a database here. I wonder if we could get the database. Because if we can get the database, we're not just getting John O'Donoghue's expense claims.
We're getting them all.
We're getting them all. And so what I did was I started going down this track of looking for the database.
Mm.
And I know I wasn't in touch with Ken at the time. We weren't friends, or we weren't in touch. But like, he was going down a separate track, which I assumed he was doing, which was to seek John O'Donoghue's expense claims as Ciarán Ciorda, which he was doing, and he eventually got, which precipitated John O'Donoghue's resignation ultimately. And I noticed all this information in the documents with Elna, and I was like, okay. I was talking to Mark Coughlin, and I was like, why don't we just FOI the database?
Mm.
Has this been done before? Has anybody actually looked for a database of a government body? So I did a couple of things. I filed one request going, I looked for elements of the database. And in the database, you could see, based on the kind of a table that was on one of the documents, you could see, well, there's a cost center number, there's the name of the expense claim recipient, there's the date of claim. There's clickable buttons on the piece of paper. You can see where they're from it. And, you know, through some Googling, you could find out that it was an Oracle system they were using. It was a system called iExpense. And you were like going, but surely these expense claims could just be routinely published anyway. Mm. If they're in a database, it's just basically just a big spreadsheet. Mm. So we started FOIing and we got refused. We sent a test FOI, first of all, to see how they'd respond.
Mm.
And they used a very set of exemptions like, they could be hacked. This is personal information, blah, blah, blah. So we sent a new request that precipitated a whole appeals process, which was just give us the whole database. And then they refused. We appealed to internal review. We appealed the internal review to the Information Commissioner, and then the Information Commissioner, the following January, so this is like January, February 2010, the Commissioner found in our favour. And well, they didn't find in our favour, they make a decision. Essentially, they brokered an agreement and said, look, if this was to go to decision, we would tell you to release it,
yeah.
so you can release it. Hmm. And sometimes that's the situation with public bodies, is that yes. they want that kind of cover.
Yes.
They want cover to go, okay, we can release it. So I got a CD-ROM in the post from the Department of Tourism and Sport that contained all the expense claims of everybody in the department back to inception. And we published it online and said, there you go. And part of the exercise there, again, is you're not necessarily getting a story. I'm not writing a story in the Irish Times about it.
Mm.
I'm just going, here's some data. We've freed it.
Yeah.
And I think people have a right to know. A bit like when you say, when you pay your taxes, why not get a receipt for where the money went? Mm. So part of that is expense claims. The other big part of it is what the government buys, and procurement is all another area.
Yeah, yeah.
How you look at FOI, what the government spends money on. So that was the kind of start of the FOI journey. And then essentially we copied that model of filing those requests and those type of requests for databases and stuff over and over and over again with multiple different public bodies. I think we ended up publishing like 5 or 6 billion euros in line item expenditure of multiple government bodies. We had a massive row with FOSS over some of their stuff. we had lots of other stuff that precipitated lots of appeals. And then one of them ended up in the NAMA case that Fred Logue was involved in.
Mm.
Around whether NAMA was a public body or not under this other law.
The AIE,
Access to Environmental Information Regulation. And that's what precipitated the whole NAMA case, that ultimately kind of, one of the rationales for setting up Right to Know as a limited company a few years ago was, I need to protect myself from costs in any court case because I don't want to be personally liable if costs are awarded against me.
Have you found over the intervening, and it's a decade or more now, that FOI has become increasingly more difficult to access the documents you want to access?
I think there's a few phases. So when we started doing the FOIs from 2009 onwards, you were paying your 15 euros for each request. And part of the kind of the way you think about 15 euros is when you have to send 15 euros of money, you want to get your cost benefit right.
Yes.
Right? So you want to get as much information as you can for your 15 euros. And what that meant was that when we were filing requests, we would look for tons of stuff under the 115 euros. Now, within reason, because, the public body can always say, look, that's a voluminous request.
And that's a
debate you can have with them. But ultimately, we would bias it towards certain things. So we would say, for the 15 euros, I'd like the calendar of the minister for the last 6 months so I can see who they've been meeting and where and when. Or I'd look for, the disclosure log to see what other FOIs have been doing, what's been released recently so I could FOI those FOIs. Or, kind of routine stuff. And then you might have it inside the FOI, the actual thing you're really looking for.
Mm.
And we've got to systemize that. But that was in the 2009 to 2014 era where you had to pay 15 euros. If you had a problem with it, you had to pay 75 euros to appeal to internal review.
Right. Yeah.
And then you had to pay 150 euros to appeal to Information Commissioner. And that was, again, like we were spending, I don't know how much we spent on appeals. And,
a lot.
We spent a lot. And then there was search and retrieval as well. Now, in fairness, people gave us money and then we spent it. So that was essentially the arrangement. And then everything we got, we'd share. And we'd also kind of establish relationships with some journalists and newspapers whereby we would say, look, we'll give you a story so it gets more play. And that will go into a newspaper, more people will read it. And after the story is published, we'll just publish the documents
online
so everybody can read them. And that was that worked reasonably well because both me and Mark Cochran were in full-time jobs at the time. This was essentially a hobby where we did all this when we got home from work.
Mm.
And we lived together at the time in Dublin. So, or we did in 2010.
Yeah.
So that was the phase up until they got rid of the fees.
Yes.
Now, we started campaigning to get rid of the 15-euro fee fairly early on in the process because we were like, this is crazy. We're one of the only countries in the world that charges up front just to file the request. I think there was only other two at the time was Canada and one other country. And then there was a hundred, 60 or 70 other countries that didn't charge at all. And we wanted to get rid of it. Now, obviously, this was right in the middle of the whole crash.
Yeah.
So the government changed because it was Fianna Fáil at the time, and then it changed over to
Fine Gael,
Labour and whatever. And Howland was minister in charge when we got to 2013, 2014 as Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, which was the lead department then for FOI and still is. So we started campaigning saying, look, this €15 fee is ridiculous. It's a ridiculous fee. The €75 is ridiculous. The €150 is ridiculous. This system was free when it was first brought in in the late 90s, but it was Charlie McCreevy on Senior Sec Gens in 2002 who wanted the fees introduced, and as a result, the number of requests fell by half. Mm. Now, we were reasonably good at arguing in the lead up to, and we engaged fairly positively in the whole pre-legislative process with the department. And I was on an external working group on implementation, all this kind of stuff. And ultimately, we got the €15 fee removed, which has doubled the number of FOI requests being filed, which I think is great. Civil servants mightn't like that. But I see it as part of the normal running of a country that you will receive requests from citizens looking for information. And then there's the reducing the fee era post 2014. Now, if I was to split them up in terms of any differences, I think before 2014, there was similar cultural problems around, you know, well, this is a luxury, not a right. You know, who do you think you are kind of asking these questions? Not in your face, but that was kind of always the underlying kind of feeling you often got from certain departments. But still, they'd release stuff and you'd be doing okay. Litigation probably wasn't as common, I think, in that era. Certainly not for me. But after 2014, I think what's happened, certainly in the last couple of years, and Ken might have talked about this as well, is you're seeing exemptions being arbitrarily applied without justification. And then you're seeing also a bias towards litigation that I haven't seen before. So sometimes what seems to be happening is you go through the whole process, you win at the information commissioner stage, and all of a sudden the public body takes the information commissioner to the High Court.
Yes.
I've been just in the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago on exactly this example, and you're kind of going, why is this happening? Because in my view, and this kind of goes to the core of access to information law, is this is a normal part of running a country. And not only that, it benefits the country. So there's a clear connection between better running of a country, better administration, and more transparency. And you know, more secrecy leads to more maladministration. So why would we not have the best laws we can? But effectively, it's all the usual suspects. It's commercially sensitive. It's a deliberative process. It's personal information. And what you'll often find is this kind of default resistance. It's like, well, they don't necessarily start with the premise of what would be the harm if we released it. They start with the premise of we're not releasing it.
Yes.
Because something might go wrong. And you're like, but that's not the purpose of the act.
And there's a spirit of the act as well.
Yeah, and repeated multiple times in Supreme Court judgments since it was brought in the late 90s, is that the whole reason it's there is that, you know, sunlight is the best disinfectant, the famous phrase from the US courts, and you know, that this is good for running a country. And it also, I think, builds a more healthy relationship between the public and their state. Like, I think part of the problem maybe is that civil servants don't like being embarrassed necessarily. So what sometimes happens is a journalist sticks in an FOI saying, how much did you spend on X? It goes into a front page story in a newspaper, and everybody's like, oh, those feckers, they just look like idiots, right? But that's the minority of FOI requests. Like, I think a lot of FOI requests are very well considered. Like, a lot of the things you've seen over the last decade that are big stories in Ireland came as a result of journalists doing legitimate FOI requests, seeking legitimate information that is in the public interest to be seen. And if as soon as those rights to access information are restricted, the less the public knows about how their money is being spent, as one of the primary examples.
It's a staggering thing, though, because, you know, we've had Transparency Ireland in, we've had, obviously you said, Ken, and we've spoken to Fred as well. And you just see, as you said, the danger of it going to litigation now is... you know, if that becoming a tactic to do it, it does seem that's really, you know, it's a blocker.
But that's also the cost. So, you will have situations now where, like, when I was in the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago on my case against the Department of Communications, and we're like nearly five years in on this case since the Information Minister first ruled. And, I mean, you had 10 barristers there. There was barristers there from the UCC, from the Information Commissioner, from the Minister, and from myself. Like, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And this is two public bodies, ostensibly three public bodies in court against each other.
And this is all paid for
by the public.
Yeah, but in that sense, it's really what happened with data protection is very much the same model. Is they will, if they don't like the decision they're given, they will force it all the way through the courts, because again, they're not paying the bills at the end of the day.
Yeah, and this is the kind of inequality of arms problem with access to information law, is that, you know, you're already at a disadvantage when you're a requester, and that's the nature of it. Is that, and this argument was being made last week as well, is that when you're a requester and you don't have access to what you're looking for, it's hard to say, well, I should have it, because you can't see it.
Yes.
So that's why the default is in the Act to say, well, the default is release, unless there's a good reason not to, which we are currently waiting on a Supreme Court judgment to make sure that that is actually the case, because that was one of the key issues that came up in the ENAC case. So I'm kind of like, you want the best access to information law that you can, and you want it to be as well implemented as you can. Oftentimes that comes down to resources, it comes down to training. But I think one of the key things is leadership. Are senior civil servants engaged and embracing the culture of transparency, as opposed to embracing a culture of refusal? And that in a lot of ways doesn't necessarily depend on the government of the day.
No.
It could be Labour, it could be Fine Gael, it could be Fianna Fáil. Because one thing you'll always see is that parties will always be pro FOI when they're in opposition.
Absolutely.
And as soon as they get into government, they're not so much pro FOI.
Same reason most of them are pro, we must do something about the defamation laws, and then if they get into government, they go, actually, they're quite comfortable, and I like them. They're good for us now.
Yeah.
And you realise that they are a barrier.
Yeah. But I think the positive to take, though, from any of the negatives that have happened since the new Act came in, is that there's a lot more requests being filed. More people are aware of their rights. Mm. The prohibition that checks imposed was actually enormous. And I made this point to Brendan Howland one day after a committee hearing. And I said to him, I said, Brendan, I'm buying stamps all the time. I can't email in requests because I have to send the postal order a check.
That's right.
And sure, he said to me, well, you're keeping on post going. And I was like, I said, that's not the way this country should run.
No.
You know, and ultimately his department, and this was during the pre-legislative phase, it was a very interesting little period of time I learned a lot about public relations actually at the time, but it's effectively at the time they tried to make fees higher.
Yeah.
And the way they tried to do it was to charge for these multifaceted requests that we were doing. So essentially it was it was the story that he was really doing these types of requests. And they said, well, we're going to charge €15 for each element of your request.
Yeah.
And we got wind of this because we were leaked a copy of the draft. A draft amendment to the FOI bill, and I wrote a blog post on this is fucking crazy if this gets true. So we kind of hit the red button. I got in contact with NGOs in Europe that I knew, like Access Info Europe in Madrid and Article 19, and we started saying, look, this is crazy. This is actually, not only is it bad, they're making it worse. And you know, it ended up that Howland was in committee. I forget which committee it was, but Mary Lee McDonald asked him a question, and this is a question we had asked as well of the department. If you file a €15 request, right, and the department or the public body gets the €15 check, how much does it cost to process the €15 check?
Yeah.
And Howland didn't have an answer. And it was the reason he didn't answer is because the department had never carried out a cost-benefit analysis of the actual charging system. Now, the answer to that question is that it's more than €15 to process a €15 check for the state. By and large, it was probably costing closer to €30 to process the €15 check. And they were trying to make the argument that this was, we need to charge because it's costing us money. And we're like, no, charging is costing you money.
Yeah.
And ultimately, the department ended up, it was a lot of bad press around this whole thing for about 4 or 5 days. And then on a Wednesday, a committee the following week, he rolled back the whole amendment and said, we're not going to do it, which was great.
Did you find it disappointing then when whistleblower legislation was used by politicians, and I mean right across the board, to hide their expenses?
Did they?
Yeah, they used the whistleblower legislation to refuse release of expenses.
Yeah, well, that was a very specific thing. But like, I think Ken would be a better person to ask about that. But I think part of the issue is that the way the Oireachtas structures its expenses regime was changed as a result of Ken's story.
It was, yeah.
So, and it was fascinating at the time how they did it, right? So me and Mark Coughlin were essentially, a bit like Ken, we were kind of politicians' expenses nerds, because I had been in London, I'd met some of the people behind the MP's expenses scandal in London in 2009 as well. And we were like, well, this is an interesting thing. And we became a bit nerdy about the whole thing, how it functioned in Ireland. Now, Brian Lennon and the government at the time, once this whole scandal came out, so we're going to reform the TD's expenses system. It's going to be really transparent. Everything's going to be great. They actually made it more opaque. They just gave flat amounts of money to politicians and then said, well, you can't actually FOI the receipts anymore because they don't even have to give them.
Yeah,
because
unvouched.
It's just unvouched.
Yeah.
It's just flat rate money. And you're like, well, and then they painted it as reform, but it was actually worse than the existing system. So I think when it comes to politicians' expenses, this came up again as well with the European Parliament. I was involved in a court case around MEPs' expenses that we ultimately lost in the General Court. But now there's kind of more impetus now around particularly members of the Commission and how much they're supposed to disclose about how much they're spending. But I think there's often problems between different pieces of legislation about how they overlap and how they might be abused between GDPR, FOI, AIE, and whistleblowing legislation. It just kind of can get complicated.
It has gotten to that point though, where you'd almost imagine like we're all out of Environmental Act nose. Just give them a GDPR one.
Yeah, and like I mean, look, if to anybody out there who wants to get information from a public body, if it's about you, do an SAR under GDPR.
Mm. Yeah,
that's the only way to do it. Don't do an FOI. You can do an FOI, but your rights are not as great. If you want to get information pertaining to yourself, just do a subject access request per GDPR. If you're looking for general information about what the government is spending money on, do an FOI. If you're doing something related to the environment, where the environment is very relatively broadly defined, file an AIE request. Well, like, and this is actually, it sounds easy, right? It sounds like, well, you just send an email and say, I'm looking for this information. One of the court cases, we were just in the High Court with Right to Know before Christmas, is a case involving us looking for information from the Department of the Taoiseach that's environmental in nature. And they refused to answer our request for environmental information unless we specifically cited the piece of law we were using. This is very, very nerdy FOI stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But essentially we said, you can't do that. A member of the public who's looking for environmental information should be able to email any public body and say, I'm looking for the following information. They shouldn't necessarily have to use the magic words in order to invoke their right, right? And the argument we're making in the High Court, and the hearing was just before, just in November, December, the argument we're making in the High Court is, but the directive on which the regulation is based, so it's a European directive, it doesn't say anything about you having to cite directly the name of the law, SI 133/2007, that if you don't use those magic words, it's not a valid request. Mm. But when we transposed it into Irish law, we added this obligation. Yes. And we're like, but that obligation is illegal because you've gone over and beyond the directive and you're also discouraging people from using their rights.
We'd always say these things, it can't be onerous.
Yeah.
It can't be onerous. I mean, there's not an actual regulatory body that exists that's worth its salt that says, well, anything that the access can't be onerous on the actual individual.
And it's really important when it comes to environmental rights because the whole framework on which you access information on the environment from the state is based ultimately on the Aarhus Convention, which was a late 1990s international treaty that Ireland ratified a few years ago. And all of Europe applies, not just to European Union countries, but across other European countries as well. And the Aarhus Convention is built on the premise that the public has a right to access information in order to protect it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're trying to vindicate those rights, but they are stated as saying, well, no, unless you use those magic words, we won't even recognize it as an environmental.
There's, just off the top of my head, there seems to be a huge parallel there then with what's happening with GDPR and the Data Protection Commissioner's Office. There's a huge parallel.
Yeah. And there's more on that coming, I'd say, soon. But like the thing about GDPR is that the process is almost identical. So the person who's usually handling your FOI or your AIE request in any given public body is also probably the data protection officer under GDPR. That's the person who has to handle your request for your own information coming in.
Mm.
And there's similar problems where they don't necessarily know how to apply the law correctly. I know it's still a relatively new law, but it's not really because we've had a Data Protection Act going back to the late 80s.
Yeah, a long time.
So this idea that there's still confusion, I don't understand because, and then there's the avenues with GDPR is, do you appeal to the DPC? Do you think you'll get your just desserts from the Data Protection Commissioner in Ireland or not? How many fines have they issued so far?
Zero.
And, or is the alternative to go to court, which GDPR does allow for, which is an interesting thing.
I found the DPC without wanting to talk about any particular cases, what they do find is similar to what you said earlier. When they are about to make a finding, they'll say, to the body involved, they'll say, you know, we're going to find against you. Do you want to settle now?
Yeah.
And then nothing will ever happen. Can I move it on to the events? So we're in the middle of a general election cycle. We're looking at things like spending on Facebook ads of 30,000-40,000, and how this stuff is regulated. You've done a lot of work on that.
Yeah, in the past. Now, I have to say, in this election, I've been paying almost no attention because I've been too busy with my business, which actually kind of came is an access information business.
Give the plug as well.
Viz Legal, we sell software to lawyers and to better access information that is already out there. But effectively, on this election, I haven't seen much, to be honest. I know journalists are working on it, and you know Facebook has their new transparency tool that you can see which parties are spending the most. And you know, I think Rachel Lavin in the Sunday Business Post has done work on this already, and there's a couple of others who've been publishing, you know, the spending data and that's coming from Facebook. But the biggest problem with Irish electoral law is that it's a mess. It's a mess, and it has been for ages. And this has been well flagged, and this has been the government understands. Coincidentally, like, we were supposed to have an electoral commission set up. I don't know how many times and how many governments, but you know, the bill or the heads of the bill was sent to John Paul Phelan sent the heads of the bill to cabinet on the 30th of December.
Shock horror.
While we were on holidays, it was like the heads of the bill for setting up the electoral commission and reform and all kinds of that, just the heads of the bill. And now, sure, it's dead because we don't even know what the new government is going to be. We don't know what work in the department is going to go ahead. And Liz Carlin has been doing really Trojan work on this issue as well around. Yeah. How do we take all of the mishmash of regulators and electoral law and put it into something that's suitable for 2020 and on? And that's it's not easy, but it's doable. Mm. But we've got electoral laws from the late 90s that are completely outdated. We've got regulation of public expenditure on ads or by political parties. And all of that is kind of just a mess. And we have the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland. We have the the Press Ombudsman. We have the Referendum Commission. We have it's all, and then we have SIPO, and we have it's just everywhere.
And I'm gonna bring it down to an even a granular level for a simple thing like posters. It's a very simple thing like posters. So right now there are about between here and the Omni Shopping Centre. There's about 50 posters that are all illegal. By a Fine Gael TD with a public meeting ones that, you know, you have to have them down 7 days after the event, but he put them up pre-election. He's kept them up now, and he's decided that he knows that worst case scenario he gets the fine, and the fine isn't even punitive enough because he can keep the posters.
And it falls
up
under the Litter Act, doesn't it?
Exactly, yeah, it's the Environmental Litter Act 1997. But he's prepared pay the fine, knowing that, you know what, actually, if it's a couple of grand, it means I staked out all of those for the weeks in the run up to the election and the weeks of it. And it's just this.
And then when it comes to things like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter, there is no law.
No.
Still. Like, and I remember I wrote this piece in the Irish Times 18 months ago, 2 years ago, arguing that in advance of the abortion referendum, that this was going to be a problem.
Yeah.
I think that was September or something. The September before the May abortion referendum, saying like these are all the problems, or these are some of them. Maybe we should start looking at addressing them because this is really pressing. Because we saw what happened during the Brexit referendum and during the election in the United States, and we've increasingly seen in many other jurisdictions since then, and yet we still haven't reformed our electoral law. Now there's been efforts and starts and fits and starts to do it under Fine Gael. But we really need to get our act together because, you know, it's only democracy we're talking about. It's only, you know.
Are you surprised that Ireland was more impervious in the repeal referendum than other constituencies or other countries had been in similar circumstances?
I guess there was a couple of things that was interesting about the abortion referendum. When I was looking at it, I was kind of purely looking at it through the lens of investigation. So when I was looking at the one of the fake Facebook pages, or essentially the audience gathering Facebook pages, I was trying to identify undecided voters. And there was this website set up called Undecided Aid or whatever, but it was actually the No campaign that had set it up. And they were trying to do audience profiling. And Facebook's reaction to that and to other things was to say, okay, we're not accepting any more ads in this area. And then Google followed on a few days later and said, okay, we're not accepting any ads at all related to the abort referendum at all. I think, I'm not sure Ireland should be complacent
okay.
about this kind of stuff. We're still learning. I mean, people forget, like, it's not that long ago that YouTube was invented. Like, it's only recently last 10 years it's become popular. Mm. So we're still grappling with how these systems work. We're still about their effect on people. And we're still kind of figuring it out. These are all relatively new things.
In 2009, when we started this conversation, you said you were sitting there and you were microblogging and you were tweeting and you rocked the world of a lot of people who didn't know that this was going to be. Now, there's journalists who are on the TV, on your news, but they're actually using their phone right now to follow someone on the campaign trail, and they're posting those 45-second clips.
Yeah.
And then their media outlet later on maybe does something else.
Yeah, but it's actually a good point about the difference in 10 years. Yeah. So like, when I went to the US for the 2008 Obama election.
Yeah.
And my friend Conor Ryan, who now works in RT, investigates... He was working at the Irish Examiner at the time, and the two of us were over in the US for the 2008 election. And I remember we drove from Washington to Chicago for the election day. And at the time, he wasn't on Twitter. He wasn't blogging. I was blogging at that stage a long time because I was one of these early nerds when it came to blogging. But I was kind of still experimenting with this idea. I don't think I even had an iPhone at the time, or I just got one. Mm. And I was like, oh yeah, I had an iPhone 3G, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I was like, Twitter is brilliant. And I remember the moment I realized Twitter was really interesting. Mm. And I was quite late to Twitter, actually, for a blogger, because I was quite a skeptic, because I was kind of a traditional long-form blogger. But I joined Twitter, I think, August 2008, and I was on the road, and we stopped in Cleveland for an Obama, Bruce Springsteen stump speech thing about 3 or 4 days before the election. And I was messing with things like live streaming. I had jailbroken my iPhone 3G, and I was live streaming on an app. Seeing people watching what I was filming, I was like, this is crazy. But I remember the moment I knew Twitter was a thing was I tweeted, I think, we went to this bar because Connor had to file copy for the Examiner and we got a pint and I was on my laptop or whatever. And I tweeted afterwards saying, oh, I had a really nice pint because they had free Wi-Fi.
Great.
And I think I tweeted about that bar or something. And then we went to the event. And took some pictures, put them on Flickr, took a couple of videos, put them online. And the guy from the bar, the barman from the bar, tweeted me and said, thanks so much for all the content. I couldn't make the event, but I got a sense of what it was like by looking at your tweets and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you want a free pint? And I was like, what?
A free pint?
This is amazing. So me and Connor went straight back to the pub after the event, and he got us to put a free pint. He was like, thanks so much for all the content.
It is, though. We live online as well, so...
But we don't get free pints. Trust me on that. We don't get... Did I say something more recently where an Irish website is also gathering data, very like that model that you were talking about in Facebook? Did I see you tweet about that recently? You can stop this if we need. Gripped.
Oh, yes. I was interested in this story because Gripped is an interesting website. Editor is John McGurk, who everybody would be aware of, especially everybody in blogging, because I would know John McGurk going back into the early days, back in the day when we used to have tweet-ups. Way back in 2008, 2009, or 2010. And it has a particular, I guess, way of looking at the world, which I would describe as right-wing. And it's, I suppose, it was a story that... was by an American journalist, I think it was last week, who spotted a subdomain of Gripped, which was traced back to a Canadian outfit that's related to Cambridge Analytica, AIQ. I think that's what they're called. And there was a subdomain that essentially meant that Gripped was explicitly connected to these guys. And I suppose I was asking John on Twitter, I said, well, How are you working with these guys? Because the people that they have admitted that they're working with are, they're not the kind of people you necessarily hire to look at your Facebook analytics and help you get more audience reach. Because if you go to their website, it's all about how do you get people to vote for you. Mm. So John has said, well, they're just helping us build our audience. And I'm like, why would you hire an outfit in Vancouver to do that? Mm. Would you not just hire a Dublin outfit to help you build your audience? There's lots of people in Dublin and London can do that. But also, why would you hire a company that's associated with Cambridge Analytica and SCL? And why would you hire a company that's associated with getting votes if you're just a right of center or right wing news publication? I mean, I don't have an answer to that question yet.
Yeah. You've asked the question. I did say you've asked the question. So I'm just interested. And it's nice to say that there is no answer yet, but there may be one forthcoming.
I don't know. But like, I mean, it's part of this isn't unique in the world. There's lots of other right-wing websites that have been employing similar strategies to build audience, identify their base, understand what content works, what content doesn't. And it's a learning experience, and you know, maybe in the future that can be connected to political campaigning, maybe not.
Hmm. Well, I think first and foremost, for the work that you've done over a long time, we've great admiration for the stuff you guys do. And it's not just you, it has to be said, and you've done it in various guises, whether it was the story, whether it's the work you do now and how you still continue to. I mean, a lot of litigation there, and if you're getting yourself into those dust ups, you're doing a public service.
Yeah, well, like, I mean, the whole objective with when we're doing the litigation that we're doing, and we're like most of our litigation at the moment is against the Information Commissioner, which in some cases we're on the same side in court and sometimes they're on the other side. So a lot of our cases are actually around vindicating rights to do with the environmental regulations. They usually boil down to two things. Is it environmental information or is it not? Mm. Is it a public body or is it not? And, you know, myself and Fred Right to Know made a complaint to Geneva. So the UN essentially oversees the Aarhus Convention, right, in Geneva. And they have a thing called the Aarhus Convention Compliance Committee. And you can make a complaint. Anybody can make a complaint to the ACC about their country's or any country's implementation of the Aarhus Convention. So me and Fred flew down to Geneva specifically because we made a complaint against Ireland to say that Ireland had a incredibly slow processes when it came to accessing environmental information. Because the NAMA case being a perfect example where we had filed a request looking for certain information and it took 5 years to even just establish the preliminary issue of whether or not there were a public body that was obliged to answer the request in the first place. So when we went down there, we were like, well, we can't really deal with this system because the system is by its nature slow and therefore I can't vindicate my rights to access information because the convention says it should be timely.
If you can't attest a right, you don't have it.
Yeah. And so therefore a lot of the litigation that we're involved in at the moment, I'm right to know we're in about 11 high court cases and we're in a case in Europe as well against the European Commission over access to technical standards. That's another long story. But those kind of cases are all around. Not necessarily that right to know is, I suppose the model that we take is a bit like, you know, you're a snowplow. And I think Max Schrems makes this point as well about his data protection litigation is if you're the snowplow, you're the person kind of leading the charge. Mm. And then by hopefully winning, all the people that are behind you, all the environmental NGOs, all the citizens, all the journalists, all benefit from the good law that you create as a result of the litigation you're doing. So ultimately, you know, it's not necessarily right to know that benefits from that. We just want to get the good law, cases, so that, you know, when an environmental NGO is looking for information about something happening in their local area, whether it's to do with fishing or to pollution or whatever, that when they do file their AIU request, that they don't have to cite the regulations, that they will get the information in a timely manner, that if it's appealed, there will be a timely manner, that all those processes work the way they should, as opposed to how it works now.
We were at a little soiree before Christmas, Tony and I.
Very fancy.
And we were with data people and FOI people, and
because that's where we like to hang out.
Such exciting guys. But it came up in conversation, and you mentioned Max, and it came up in conversation that generally the people who are breaking the ice and being forced in there, they're a little bit mad. Mm. Are you a little bit mad?
Oh, definitely. I'm definitely a little bit mad. And I think a lot of it boils down to I don't know. I tend to take an interest in things and then just try to fully own them or fully understand them, if you know what I mean. So with FOI, it went from filing my first request to filing hundreds of requests to understanding the entire FOI regime to trying to push the change in the legislation then to setting up an NGO that focuses on litigating the whole thing. Yeah. And that's 10 years of work. But then you're also mad because you're also trying to do three other things at the same. So at the same, and this is like, there was this crazy time when me and Mark Coughlin were living together in Dublin, which was essentially, Mark and me were working in Storyful together. He was working in the Irish Times and RT and Storyful at the same time. I was working in Storyful and we were essentially getting home from work and doing FOI requests and running the story.ie and publishing documents. And we used to just get nerdy stuff. Like we used to just get, I remember I got a copy of some tribunal report and just scanned it. I spent like 2 weeks scanning it. I think it was the Beef Tribunal report or something. And I was like, we'll just put it online. Why? Because nobody can find it.
Yeah.
Even though if you're a researcher, an academic, you're a journalist, you want to just look it up and read it or read up or search it or look for something. It has to be digitized. It has to be OCR'd. Yeah. It has to be made searchable. And all those things are nerdy. But I think ultimately you're trying to go, well, how do we push the boundaries on this thing? And I suppose that's all of my, I guess, disciplines all boil down to access to information rights.
Yes.
That includes Storyful. So even when we were in Storyful, a lot of it was, you know, you're doing open source investigations into things like, you know, bombings in Syria. And, you know, Storyful was this kind of almost incubator of lots and lots of very, very, very good journalists. A lot, you know, there's some of the original crew still there, but it's much bigger now since it was acquired. But a lot of the alumni of Storyful have gone all over the world to work in lots of things. So Manichae's in the New York Times, Vincent's nephew as well, you know, Phelim is in the ICC, and like there's a lot of people have gone on to do really good things. But with Storyful, it was a lot of it was an access to information problem. It was like, well, there's all this noise on social media. How do we filter it and understand when an event happens? And how do we identify and verify content that comes from that event? So, you know, it's a very interesting company to work in, or to work in from the beginning. Was, well, we have this problem, which is loads of people have phones. And this kind of goes back to like being in 08, being in Chicago for Obama winning and watching the change happening. You have all these people who are getting these smartphones. Well, number one, I remember meeting Mark in the Morrison Hotel back in the middle of 2009. For breakfast with Mark Coughlin as well. And we were talking about, you know, where is all this stuff going? This was before Storyful was set up.
It was born, yeah.
Yeah, and we were talking about it, and we were like, well, I said to Mark, I was like, everybody's going to have one of these phones, right? And what we can say for sure is that the phones are going to get better, so they're going to get faster because you're talking Moore's Law, you're talking to trending technology.
Yeah.
The camera's going to get better, the connectivity is going to get better, and the ability to share and distribute content is going to get way, way easier than it is now. Because if you think the iPhone 3G, which I had at the time, is any good, imagine what it's going to be like in 2 or 3 years' time. And at the time, the iPad was only a rumor. So I was like, look, the iPad's going to come out as well, and it's just going to be this massive amount of content. And Storyful's essential pitch as a company was, well, there's a wild west of content out there, and it's growing. Who's going to find the key bits, make sure it's real, And then distribute that to all the other newsrooms so that they can do their jobs better as well. And that's what Storyful essentially did for the 4 years I was there.
If it's any consolation at all, your work, Fred's work, and the others who work in GDPR as well, and before that, data protection, over the years, I have absolutely copied and pasted and used and to very, very good effect in that what you're doing is you are breaking a path, but I was the guy coming along behind going, oh, I can use that section 28.1. Yeah, I'll use that argument there. I'll
that's what
that
you want.
Argument there.
That's the model you want.
Exactly what I did.
Last call for me. How can people support what you guys do?
So with Right to Know, you can go to righttoknow.ie and you can subscribe for, I think our, you can scroll yearly. We don't have a Patreon yet. That's my New Year's resolution, is to make a Patreon for Right to Know. At the moment, it's just a yearly amount. And that money essentially is spent on legal fees most of the time for Fred and for barristers that we hire. Everything I'm going to do is kind of done on contingency. So we're essentially just litigating. And when we win, everybody gets paid. If we lose,
nobody gets paid.
And the best of luck with VizLegal as well.
So with VizLegal, if anybody wants to try it out, you can go to VizLegal.com and have a free trial. We just signed up the Bar Council of Ireland in October. So we have hundreds of barristers using us specifically for things like tracking cases in the High Court, searching judgments. And we're always adding new data. So we've added in all the, you know, European Court of Human Rights judgments, all the Court of Justice of the European Union. We just added in all the Workplace Relations Commission decisions, Labour Court decisions, EAT decisions, Employment Equality Tribunal decisions, going back to 1986 into the system as well.
Excellent.
Martin, we also, Martin's going to opt in for a free trial.
And we also send these cool alerts where you just get alerted for all the new cases filed every morning. In the High Court, all the new WRC decisions issued, all that kind of stuff.
That's brilliant.
So,
and
what we're trying to do with is legal. And again, it's the same theme. It's an access to information problem. There's all these websites people have to use in order to access these decisions. Yeah. They're kind of all over the place. We try to make that data much better and cleaner and put it on in a reasonable format and get it on your phone. And then once you have it there, we try to charge as little as possible as we can get away with for what we sell it for.
For the lay litigant, that's kind of nice too, that you could have it on your phone.
Yeah. So, and that includes the rules of the courts, which are actually consolidated. So if you are a lay litigant and you have to deal with the courts.
Yeah.
You need to know the rules and you need to know the practice directions. But they're not necessarily consolidated, so you don't know when they were amended and when they changed and what you're supposed to do, what form you're supposed to fill in, how you file the form. All this stuff is reasonably complicated, so we're trying to make that a little bit easier for lawyers to start with. But hopefully, if the model evolves and the business goes well, we can start kind of making other processes easier for lay litigants as well.
Thank you.
Kevin, Sharon, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Thanks, folks. Talk to you all soon. It's righttoknow.ie. You can get on the look. You don't need to tell me, Gavin. You'll all know Gavin on Twitter. But go on and check that out. That's amazing work. Talk to you all soon.
Bye-bye. Bye.